Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This podcast is part of the Planet Broadcasting Network.
Visit planetbroadcasting.com for more podcasts from our great mates.
Welcome to Listen Now, the podcast where we go through the most important and rockin'est albums of all time. This season, we're focusing on albums from the 1980s. I'm your host, Matt Stewart, and with me, as always, is my co-host and co-cousin, Sam Tonkin. Welcome, Sam.
Welcome, Matt. It has been a while.
It's been a while.
This is our third attempt at recording
this episode.
Yeah, fingers crossed we actually figure this one out. The first one, my laptop decided 15 minutes in that it was time for an update. Thank you, MacBook. Not sponsored. And the second time, we just couldn't.
Just general technical difficulties. And I can already feel tonight that you are on massive delay. So looking forward to the problems that is going to garner. This week, we're talking about, as the listeners know from the title of the podcast this week, we're talking about The Clash's mammoth hit album from 1982, Combat Rock. It was voted as the 14th most popular 80s rock album by our listeners. If you want to know what the next album we're going to be talking about, listen all the way through to the end after the theme music, and I'll let you know then. Now, Sam, what was your relationship with The Clash growing up?
Well, as our dear listeners know, I listened to a lot of Triple M throughout my childhood, and so the big hits that were on Triple M are the ones that I knew, but that's kind of essentially it. I did go through the early 2000s emo phase, as so many of us did, and thought that I was like an absolute ledge because I knew like four Clash songs, but never actually listened to an album through.
Yeah, right. What were the four songs you knew?
London Calling, Rock the Casbah, Should I Stay or Should I Go? And I think that was it.
The four songs I knew were three coolest songs. But yeah, that they probably are their big three, I guess. Two of which are on the album we're talking about today. So it's probably no real surprise that this was their biggest selling album.
Yeah. What about you? What was your relation?
Well, I think I was relatively similar. I knew those songs and maybe a few others as well. And I bought sometime during my teens, I bought the singles collection, which was a double.
You do love a greatest hits.
A double CD, which had, you know, all those and heaps more. But probably even before then, the first I really knew of them was. It, not actually them, it was Mick Jones's band afterwards, Big Audio Dynamite. When I was young, like in preschool or early primary school, but I think probably before primary school, Big Audio Dynamite had a few hits.
It was 90s, wasn't it?
Yeah, was it 90s? Yeah, maybe it was early 90s. They started in the 80s and then had a few hits in the early 90s. So I would have been in primary school. Mm-hmm. And one of them, in fact, even samples a Clash song. He samples himself
on
the Globe.
I'm gonna sample myself.
Yeah, sampled a little bit of "Should I Stay or Should I Go." Nice. Well, I can play that here now if you want to hear a little bit of it. Do you remember Big Audio Dynamite much?
I think I remember what the songs are, but I didn't realize for a long time. Yes, absolutely. Yes,
that woo bit.
Wow!
That's just...
Oh, I just tried that. It was not even close.
That's just one little bit at the start of Should I Stay or Should I Go, which we'll hear later, but they repeat it throughout this song. And this was... I think this wasn't a big hit anywhere apart from maybe Australia and New Zealand.
I will look that up. What's it called? The Globe?
The Globe. Yeah. It's very 90s sounding. It's a lot of fun. Real party music, I reckon. Which I think Mick Jones was maybe... Maybe that was his strong suit from The Clash. He'd write real danceable music.
Yep. 1991 it was released.
Yeah, it's just funny to think of me as like a...
Do what you like.
A little kid bopping along to this.
Yeah. So it was...
And this was the follow-up single to Rush, which was a worldwide hit.
Yes. The Globe came number 8 for us.
Right.
But it was like in the high 70s for the Billboard 100.
And then this one, I think, was, top 10 around the world. And, you know, I think it holds up. I think it's still a banger.
This is a cracking song.
So, yeah, for quite a while I thought, Should I Stay or Should I Go was a big Audio Dynamite song when I was a kid. Had it all backwards. Because his voice and style so distinctive, I guess. You can...
Yeah.
Should I Stay or Should I Go fits in pretty well with these kind of sounds. I mean, it's not quite as 90s-ified, but...
I like how thick his accent remains in this. Like, you know, a lot of times that people be from any part of the world and they just, for some reason, end up singing very American. Like, just a very generic American accent.
Yeah, right. I think it, singing often, like, I guess it just smooths out any accents. So maybe it...
Yeah, it's weird.
It almost, unless you're... a lot of people become
unless you're walking
neutral.
500 miles and then you're walking 500 miles.
Or you're an Aussie hip-hop artist or something. Or you're allowed to... Yeah, if hip-hop, I guess, is one where accents remain stronger.
Skip hop in Australia.
The Drones, they're a band that really... Gareth Lydiard doesn't let his accent go. You know much of The Drones?
I think I know maybe one song, but it'd be by sound, not by North American.
Right. They've got a track that's one of the all-time great songs. I'll play a little bit of it now. We're getting sidetracked so early.
Am I surprised?
I think we're just excited that we're actually... It looks like this episode might actually happen this time. This is Shark Fin Blues. Oh, no, it's not.
That is... I was like, yeah, I do know that one.
let me get to some vocals.
I don't know, but I see what you mean about the accent.
Yeah, I love his voice. This song is sick, and it builds and builds over like 6 minutes.
Excellent.
But we're not here to talk about Australian music necessarily. We should do an episode, a special episode about Aussie bands who maintain their accent.
I'm writing it down in my notes. My episode notes.
Or maybe just, it doesn't have to be Australian, but just bands who maintain, sing with an accent.
Love that.
But we're here to talk about The Clash, so I'm sorry for that early sidetrack. So on the... on the greatest hits that I had, the singles album, that had so much good stuff in it. You can track in a band by their singles. It's not always that accurate, but I think you can really hear their sound evolve in the pretty short amount of time they were around, which you'll tell us about soon with their biography. But songs White
was your
Riot.
Was your best of chronological or just...
I believe it was chronological,
Yeah, so that'd be a real good snapshot of development over time,
Yeah, I think I prefer it when a greatest hits is chronological because I know makes some sense to put it out like it's an album, so you want to have a good opener to open, et cetera.
Yep.
But
opener.
I think when it's a greatest hit, so I'm happy to throw that out the window and just hear it chronologically.
I agree. I think it's a good measure. It's a good... it's just a good way to learn about a band, especially if that's, your intro.
Yeah, I can skip through a few of these combat rock tracks. So White Riot, pretty early Doors. That's just more of that classic punk sound.
Yeah, this is like, this sounds like 1977 to me. Because, you know, I was there.
Yeah. Does it take you back? That's probably one of my favourites. I love Clash City Rock as well. I just love this simplicity of this riff is sort of bouncy. I love it.
Oh, I Fought the Law. That's the other one I know. There is Four.
Yes, that is the
I Fought the Law.
I Fought the Law. Yeah, that's a cover, but it's, I mean, it's one of those songs that it's like, once they did it, maybe just to people of a certain age, but that feels like theirs is the definitive version. But maybe
yeah,
older
there's
people
a few songs
would
around, yeah, that are others like that. That people are like, this is a Torn by Natalie Imbruglia cover.
Yeah.
Fact. Learned that, blew my tiny mind.
So, Tommy Gunn's another cracker. These are all Joe Strummer and vocal songs.
That sounds very of the era. And I like it.
Yeah, it's a good era. Then you've got I Fought the Law, which you were talking about before. Which is a banger. Love those drums and how it fades up.
Yep.
Like a horse riding into town.
Yeah, yes.
I guess that's what I'm probably going for. Yeah, this is a fucking banger.
I fought the law and the law won.
Then you had London Calling, which is, I think it's often seen as sort of their masterpiece. Oh, I mean, there'd be differing opinions on
that. That was their first album, wasn't it?
Sorry?
That was their first album? No.
No, London Calling was their, I think it was their.
That's that iconic cover.
Yeah, that's right.
It's got London and Calling.
It was released at the end of 79, so that's why it wasn't eligible for this show. So I think it was there was one more and then the one we're talking about, so it was a couple back from Combat Rock. But yeah, they'd already, I mean, you can hear this, their sound's already developed quite a bit since the White Riot sort of stuff. I don't know how many of these older songs we're gonna play. We could probably go through some of these later. I don't know. I Train in Vain, just to hear one of Mick Jones' other tracks.
Yep.
This is a really pop rocky sort of song.
Well,
you
and you
hear the difference in styles between Joe Strummer and Mick Jones.
Yeah, this is a good, like,
anyway, we can play.
We could go on.
We could play other Clash songs all night long, but we're here to talk about Combat Rock.
Combat.
So, do you want to go through a bit of a bio? Because I mean, I know a fair bit, but I don't think I at all have an encyclopedic knowledge of the Clash. I've just sort of gleaned bits and pieces as I've gone along. I've never watched a doco or anything like that, which I...
No.
All of a sudden, I'm feeling a big appetite to go back and do that. I've watched a bunch
appetite
of early punk documentaries where they come up a lot, but none specific to The Clash?
Yeah, because everyone references, they're like, yeah, man, they were one of our inspirations.
Yeah.
Like, everybody of any sort of like punk, remotely punk kind of band is like Clash.
I think there was an iconic show. I don't know if it was The Clash or the show The Clash went to. It was either... Oh, this is, I mean, why bring it up if you don't know the details? But I think it was an early Clash show that, and they say that everyone in the audience that night formed a band the next day. Or was it the Ramones, and that's where the Clash formed their band? Damn it. It's a good anecdote if you remember it.
It was. I think I talk about it later. I'm pretty sure it's...
Enough of me mumbling about. Let's hear the bio.
Let me not go on. Also, Matt's other podcast, Do Go On. Also, you can find it on podcasts and everywhere you find good podcasts. And if you can't find it, rethink your choices.
Oh, jeez.
Can I do voiceover work? Can that be my corona like side hustle? Voiceovers.
You could definitely try.
Apps, probably.
Anyone listening who needs some voiceovers done, I mean, get in contact with Sam. She sounds like she's available.
Yep, that's accurate. So, The Clash. Before The Clash actually came together, all of the members, or pretty much all the members, were different parts of different bands that were kind of scattered around London mostly. That was like central. That was, you know, punk city. Old mate Joe Strummer sang and played rhythm guitar for the 101ers, which had formed in 74. He originally started music as a busker playing ukulele, which is not what I expected from one of the most prominent frontmen in all of punk rock. Other main guy, Mick Jones, was playing guitar as expected in a band called London SS, who rehearsed a lot, never played a live show, but did record a demo. They were managed by Bernard. How do you... Bernard Fanning, but I would read it as Bernard. It's like Jared or Gerard.
Bernard Fanning, isn't it?
I thought it was Bernard Fanning. It is Bernard Fanning.
I think it depends on where you're from. I think... I've learnt this recently that apparently elsewhere in the world they say Gerard and we say Jared. So it's probably the same as that.
The singer from My Chemical Romance, I read it as Jared Way, but people call him Gerard
Way. Well, that's how I found out,
like,
because
what the fuck's a Gerard?
On another podcast I do,
Gerard
Primates,
the Giraffe.
This season's been about the Umbrella Academy, which he wrote. And
Of course.
I've been calling him Jared Way, and a few people messaging saying it's actually Gerard.
How do they spell that when they're trying to correct it?
I think maybe they gave me some sort of phonetics or something to work with.
Oh, good. Like, do you capitalize? Anyway, I'm getting distracted again. But 76 rolls around right before the absolute explosion of punk rock, and London SS broke up. Bernard, wherever you want to call him. I'm going to call him Bernie. Bernie remained Mick Jones' manager. And early in 76, Jones saw the Sex Pistols perform for the first time. And he's quoted as saying, "You knew straight away that was it. And this was what it was going to be like from now on. It was a new scene, new values, so different from what had happened before, a bit dangerous." And he frothed it, absolutely loved it. And then from Bernie, our mate, Bernie got Mick Jones to contact, I can't remember what his first name is, I actually didn't write it down, but one of the members whose last name is Simonon.
Paul.
Simonon, who was a bassist. But I don't think he actually played that instrument currently. He was told by Bernie to learn an instrument so he could then join this new band that Mick Jones was trying to form. Anyway, they got together. They were still looking for a lead singer, and Joe Strummer had been contacted. And only in April previous, he had actually been watching. So he was having a show because he was, you know, living his best life, and the Sex Pistols were opening. And he went and watched them pre his performance with his band, the 101ers. And he's quoted as saying as well, he's like, "Something's happening." And he went out to have a look, and pub rock, he described it as, "Hello, you bunch of drunks. I'm going to play these boogies and I hope you like them." And then the Sex Pistols came out, And he said, their attitude was, here's our tunes and we couldn't give a flying fuck whether you like them or not. In fact, we're going to play them even if you fucking hate them. And that was like it. Yeah, same reaction as Mick Jones, light bulb moment. Like, this is the new it. And then it's funny, you know how we talked about Jimmy Barnes didn't like Don Walker at the start because he was like, he's a bit older, dresses a bit too nice. What's he got business in rock kind of thing. A few members of the band that had kind of gathered together had the same feeling about Strummer. And they saying, you know, he was 22 or 23 or something. And to them, who are, I think, were like their late teens, were like, this bloke's old. He's wearing retro clothes. He's got a croaky voice. I'm not about it. But then they heard him sing for the first time, you know, all together, and they're like, yes. Yes, this is it.
Yeah, right.
And then so that was, I think that was mid to late 76. They kind of all got together. 77 comes along, bang, explosion. And Joe Strummer talks about, he got contacted a lot about their signing of a big CBS Records contract, which was one of the big wigs in music back then. They signed it for £100,000, which at that time had about 30 total gigs, nearly none as a headliner. And, you know, as the punk scene kind of seems to do, is tear each other apart from the inside. It's not so supportive, I suppose you could say, of those making it, because as soon as you start making it, you're called a sellout. So he had to face a lot of interviews, a lot of questioning about how he felt having sold out because they just signed $100,000. And he's like, mate, I'm not going to turn into fucking Rod Stewart overnight just because I signed this contract. Like, we're still making the music that we're about to make, and now I'm just free to do it without having to worry about, you know, trying to pay for my rent tomorrow, or, you know, my stomach hurts because I haven't eaten for 4 weeks kind of thing. So that was a really big turn in the scene, in punk history in general.
Yeah.
And then 79 rolls around and they released London Calling, which, as we discussed, was huge. And it was really big for its time in terms of music history as well, because not only is it following up punk rock, which is, you know, still in its peak at this time, but it's a mix of punk rock, reggae, ska, rockabilly, traditional rock and roll, plus a whole bunch of different elements, which at that point in time had never been heard radio-wise before. And the name, I think it's London Calling, is actually heavily influenced by the BBC World Service call signal and the panic that resulted in the Three Mile Island nuclear scare. Whatever that was, I probably should have researched that. Sorry about it. But then, you know, they released another couple of albums in between, and then comes Combat Rock.
It was just
what we're talking about today.
Sandinista.
So, yeah.
Is that why you didn't say what it was? So that was the album in between.
Yes, it is.
And that was it.
Yep.
An even more ambitious album. It was a three-disc. So
three-parter.
London Calling was a double. Then they went to a triple. So I was like, where can they go from here? And I think Sandinista was even more styles, or at least as many, but I think even more.
Broader.
I think they even hit some rap in there. And it's really all over the shop. And probably for that reason, it's, you know, quite inconsistent, but it's got big hits in there as well. Hitsville UK, for
seems
instance,
to be like,
and the Magnificent Seven. The 80s
style is just like, you know what? I think we talked about it previously. Like, let's put a different genre for every track of this album kind of music.
Yeah.
Was it 20th Century from Cold Chisel? Straight up, there you go.
Yeah, Cold Chisel did it. Huey Lewis of the News did it, even when we heard earlier in this season. Every song on that was very different. I think, it was just a big thing in the 80s was to experiment with genres a lot in a way.
Why
that
not?
Maybe they don't do as much anymore, or like the album might be experimenting with genres, but it's more likely to be a bit more consistent than they used to do, at least on the big albums, I think. They'll be more cohesive than they used to be. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm not officially a rock historian, so I can't say that for sure, but that's the vibe I get.
We're working on it. We've been trying to contact our mate Zup. I feel like what's up with Zup, he'd know about it, but he's still not replied to us.
No.
I've followed up. I've sent him. I've added him.
So now we've got...
If someone knows what's happened to Zup,
please. So we've got up to the big hit album, Combat Rock. So they're on a hot streak anyway. I mean, it's not like this is out of nowhere. This is just another hit album.
Mm-hmm. Why not, you know?
Yeah.
And so the album came out. It was mostly well received. There were described as offbeat songs scattered throughout, experiments with sound collage, and a spoken word vocal by beat poet Allen Ginsberg. You know, because again, why not? And then they've got their two radio-friendly tracks, Should I Stay or Should I Go, and Rock the Casbah, which has been described on my best mate Wikipedia as lyrics addressing the Iranian clampdown on imports of Western music to a bouncy dance rhythm. The album itself charted number 32 in Australia and number 5 in New Zealand, came in number 2 in the UK and number 7 in the US Billboard Pop Albums. And for anyone who's interested, number 12 in Canada, 29 in Holland, 7 in Norway, and 9 in Sweden. I nearly said Norwegia. Good old Norwegia.
And I went double platinum in America, so that's a
large,
big deal.
Yep.
Big album.
2 million sales.
Yeah, wow. That's hectic.
Or upwards of, I suppose.
Before we get into playing the tracks, a good friend of the show, he's been a guest before, Dave Warnicki, who is, The Clash is one of his favorite bands. So I asked him if he'd be up for doing a little review of
Is that
this
Dave
album.
Warnicki, also of Do Go On Podcast, which you can find everywhere at Do Go On Pod.
That's right. It is that same guy. Why are you plugging Do Go On so hard today?
I don't know, because it's been easy so far. Setups,
look,
knock them down.
I got to tell you, I appreciate the support.
That's what we're here for.
Are you up for hearing a little bit of what Dave has to say?
Absolutely.
Okay. I was a bit worried. I thought I should have brought this up earlier.
This is awkward. No.
Okay. So let's throw it over to Dave Warnicki.
Hey, listen now. Dave Warnicki here, demanding that you listen now to my voice as I talk.
Good shout out.
Thanks for asking me to talk about one of the best bands ever, The Clash. They are my mum's favourite band of all time, so I grew up listening to them. We've even got some home video of me dancing around to them and the Smiths as a 3-year-old, so pretty cool kid. But let's talk Combat Rock, considered by many of their fans to be their last album. Most people don't talk about the follow-up, Cut the Crap, which is advice that the band seem to have ignored. Combat Rock is one for the ages and the last to feature the classic lineup. Now, all of the Clash albums open with an absolute banger, and they continued the trend with Combat Rock. The opening track, Know Your Rights, starts with the line, "This is a public service announcement," which is such a great line to start an album. And then they just don't stop from there. Side 1, when it was released on record, features some of their biggest tracks. Many people know them, even if they're not big Clash fans. Should I Stay or Should I Go?, Straight to Hell, and Rock the Casbah. And also the bass player, Paul, busting out Red Angel Dragnet. Love that track. Love Paul. Side 2 opens with a song that for any other band would sound like a joke, overpowered by funk. But The Clash, they pull it off, baby. You know why? Enter the band's secret weapon, the band's rhythm section. Paul Simonon is, in my opinion, one of the best bass players to ever play in a rock band. Such amazing groove. You can also hear him on every song. He's just always there. Sounds fantastic, but not too much. He's not really showing off. It just sounds awesome. He brings sort of that reggae vibe to a lot of songs that otherwise most bass players probably wouldn't have done that. Not bad for a guy that when he was recruited into the band, he couldn't even play bass guitar. So great stuff, Paul. And then Top of the Drummer just never stops. Constant, truly a great drummer. I love the groove they have on track 11, also on the second side, Inoculated City. Great stuff, guys. Up there with the Beatles and Fleetwood Mac, The Clash have got to be one of the best bands with multiple vocalists. But unlike the Beatles and the Mac, the reason they rule isn't because they sound great together, but they all sound so different. We're not talking harmonies, we're talking very individual voices. Joe Strummer's out the front being all punk, Mick Jones has this awesome pop voice, which is so good to listen to, and Paul Simonon, again, I can't really describe it, but I love it. The Guns of Brixton, fantastic stuff. I also love the collaboration of the band. Joe sang all the songs on the first self-titled album. Then Mick wrote and sang just one song on the second album, a song called Stay Free, another great bass line, and it was my favourite song on that album. Then Paul wrote and sang only one song on London Calling, The Guns of Brixton, and it was the album's best song, in my opinion, again. And on this album, Topper the drummer wrote the music for Rock the Casbah, and in my opinion, that's the album's best song. An endearing classic. They just share it round, and they pull the songs back together, and they just sound awesome. And speaking of Rock the Casbah, I'm not alone on thinking that that is a great, great track. One time a few years back, I was hosting a trivia night for a father-daughter school camp. And yep, that's a weird event to host, but I was there. The idea was to have some questions for the kids, mostly One Direction at the time, and some questions for the dads, which is mostly about footy at the time. Then afterwards, I was paid to play music for an hour. So I alternated between One Direction and other stuff, and I chucked on Rock the Casbah for the dads, and a really drunk dad got up and started dancing on a table. He was the only one dancing, and then he yelled out at the top of his lungs, "Best song of the 80s, yeah!" Then he fell off the table.
Yes.
But you know what, drunk man? I agree with you. There's a reason The Clash have been called the only band that matters. Combat Rock was the last proper album from that band. Absolutely good stuff. 5 out of 5. Thanks, Matt and Sam. Love your work.
Oh, cheers, Dave. It's a great
Legend.
Review.
Legend. That was an excellent review. That is a weird gig to be hosting and playing music at, but on your dad. For having a little tabletop dance, good for you.
Yeah.
Live your life.
Totally. I feel like I want to play a little bit of The Guns of Brixton because it does sound like that's one of Dave's favourite tunes. So,
What album did he say it was on?
London Calling. So here's a bit of it.
Oh, that's some dirty bass. Dirty bass. Wait, she's funky. When they kick at your front door, how you gonna come? Put your hands on your head or on the trigger of your gun. When the law break in, how you gonna go? Shot down on the pavement or waiting in death pool. You can crush us, you can bruise us, but you'll have to answer too.
Such a good tune. Such a good tune.
I'm about
yeah.
it. I'm a booty.
So that one was one of Paul Simonon's tracks. And I think that's him on vocals as well. Like Dave was saying.
Oh, was it? Yeah.
Yeah, he's probably closer to Strummer's vocal, but not really.
Yeah, I reckon.
Mick Jones is so singular. No one sounds like him.
It is.
Whereas
it's very unique.
Yeah.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Yes, okay, so shall we get into the tracks?
Let's delve.
So the album opens up, like Dave was saying, with an absolute banger, Know Your Rights.
This is a public service announcement with guitar.
I love that smashing beep, beep. Sound in the background.
Yeah, what is? Just sounds like someone absolute slamming at a guitar. Yeah.
So I'd say this is the punkest song, like most classically punk song on the album.
Yeah. Do you know, because we've tried to record this episode a few times as
we've never
earlier.
Got this far into it. This is very exciting.
No, this is, fingers crossed, don't jinx it. Touching wood. Oh yeah, so the first time I listened to this, I was a bit... Like, didn't know how I felt about it as an opener. And the more I listen to it, the more I'm like, yo, This is nice.
Yeah, I mean, like a lot of their stuff, it's very political.
Yeah, which, you know,
talks about
exercise your political beliefs. Why not?
Talks about knowing your rights, all three of them, and then it sort of undercuts all of them.
At least three.
you're not allowed to kill unless you're a cop or an aristocrat, stuff like that. It's real cutting political commentary.
What year did we say this was released? 85?
82.
Why did I get 85? Didn't they break up in 85, 86?
So, I mean, all good stuff. All good, helpful stuff there, Sam. Thank you so much. This next...
Yep. That's my job on the...
Yeah, you're the one meant to be bringing the info. I'm bringing the charisma. Charisma.
No, I think you were right the first time.
So, the next track, big vibe Matthew. Change for Car Jammin'.
Mm-hmm. Is it the Floor Toms?
Yeah, I guess so.
It's a bit George of the Jungle, isn't it?
They were highly influenced by George's work.
He was big in the 70s. Love that.
So those first two tracks are strummer on lead vocals, and then track three, yep, we move over to the first big hit of the album. Should I Stay or Should I Go with Mick Jones?
Which is just a fucking cracking song, tune, isn't it?
Which would obviously go on to influence and inspire the cracking Big Audio Dynamite song, The Globe.
Globe.
I mean, all these little choices they make with the songs, in and out of them, are so much fun. They seem to like to play in the studio a little bit.
Yeah.
It's got an old school rock vibe somehow as well.
Is it the speed?
Yeah, I
don't
guess
know.
So,
I know
yeah.
what you mean. But then here we are, we're just joking. It'll kick in and then we're like, actually we're back in 70, 80, whatever. 82. One day is fine and next is black.
So if you want me off your back. It sounds like a slowed down Chuck Berry riff or something.
Oh, what a call.
I have no idea what I'm talking about. Should I stay or should I go
now? Should I stay?
And then track four, like the hits don't stop there, because track number four is another hit, and it is what Dave called the best track on the album, and so did that drunk man at the party. Not best track of the album, best track of the 80s.
Best track of the 80s. Yeah,
and it's an absolute boogie.
So this bad boy here was, as you mentioned, written by Topper, the drummer, and he just found himself one day in the studio alone. So he pretty much put all of this together after playing around with a piano riff, which obviously turned into this. And he put it to the band. Band absolute loved it, except Joe Strummer looked at the lyrics that he'd written, which was some sappy "I miss my girlfriend" shit. And Joe Strummer picked it up. He's like, well, that's interesting. Screw it up in a bowl and chucked it in the bin. And then he went to the bathroom in the recording studio and wrote some new lyrics with some quotes that he'd been thinking with, which Rock the Casbah was one of. And now we're here.
Yeah, right. So he sounds like he was a bit of a jerk there, but...
I mean, it's punk, man.
Oh, sorry, he's a bit punk. That was punk as fuck what he just did.
Excuse me, I would just like to be a bit punk for a hot sec. and fuck your lyrics.
So the next track, and this is like that holds up. Rock the Casbah, like you said, that was a song that crossed over into you knew it from. It was one of the four that sort of the big four that have probably crossed over to most people who were around.
Yeah, I'd be shocked if I met someone who hadn't heard that before.
Yeah, I think
it's just one of those songs that people. Just
yeah, know. As time goes on, I'm getting less shocked when people don't know old songs. It's because people are, you know, you meet someone now who's 18. It's like they were born in 2002.
Oh, no,
why would they know that? But
my younger siblings, who are only 5 years younger than me, didn't know what Mbop was until 5 years ago. And the shame that I felt.
That they didn't know it.
That was my first crush. Yeah, my first crush was the drummer who was 10 and I was 5. So clearly, he was way too old for me. But they didn't know what Mbop was. Also, Thinking of You, a Kraken song from their first album. If anyone's interested
you
in
have,
Hanson's first
You have
album.
A real weird back catalogue of tunes that you find influential.
I like to think of it as eclectic. Different. Different. It's nice. Different.
So there's two more tracks on side one. This one, I think this one's... Because I didn't know this song before. I'd never listened to this album before the last month or so, and I've been playing it quite a bit. And I reckon this is one of the ones that has really stood out to me from the ones I didn't know. I knew No Your Rights. I knew Should I Stay or Should I Go. I knew Rock the Casbah. I knew Straight to Hell, and I didn't know any of the other ones. And I reckon this one was a bit of a standout from that. And it's got Paul Simonon on lead vocals. This is his first appearance on the lead vocals, and maybe even only on this album. And you can tell. Yeah, it changes the vibe a little bit, but it's a cool song. It's called Red Angel Dragnet.
It's got a bit of Blondie about it, I reckon, this intro. I come from a long way away. I love that. A long way away. I love that quote. I wrote that down because I liked it so much.
Which line?
Something about that's the reason that no one ever pointed a telescope at the sun.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, I think it's another cracking tune, that one. The next one, track six, Straight to Hell. It's one of their... Another one of their songs that's seen by a lot of people as their masterpiece, one of their great tracks. I imagine you've got some stuff to talk about this before we play it, Sam.
Which one? Straight to Hell?
Yeah.
I do, actually. And the first time I heard this, which was only about a month ago, realized that it had been used heavily in a sample for a song that probably a lot of people will know, even if they were born after the year 2000. that I didn't actually realize was a sample. And I'm just going to leave it at that, and hopefully you can hit the old play button.
Oh, yeah? Just play it? All right. So here is track six, Straight to Hell, closing out side one.
I fly like paper, get high like planes. If you don't know that... Well,
so the sample you're talking about is MIA's
Paper Planes.
Paper Planes. It was a big hit, and it was on the Pineapple Express soundtrack.
Yes, that's where it really blew up, I think.
But yeah, this is just a real low key banger.
Clear as winter ice.
So, this is what Joe Strummer said about this song. He said, I'd written the lyric, staying up all night. I went down to Electric Lady and I just put the vocal down on tape. We finished about 20 to midnight. We took the E train from the village to up to Times Square. I'll never forget coming out of the subway exit just before midnight into 100 billion people. And I knew we had just done something really great.
Nice. Just a casual 100 billion. Approx.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great tune.
It's a fun one. I first listen, I was mostly just focused on the clip that MIA had sampled. But the more I listen to it, it's such a mood. I really will happily listen to that a lot, I think, going forward.
Oh, it's an all-timer for sure.
It's great.
Apparently, this is what Topper said about the drum beat. He said, you couldn't play rock and roll to it. Basically, it's a bossa nova. Joe Strummer has said, just before the take, Topper said to me, I want you to play this. And he handed me an R. White's lemonade bottle in a towel. He said, I want you to beat the bass drum with it. That's how they got part of that sound.
What?
It's a bottle in a towel hitting the drum.
Okay. Oh, that's why it's such a muffled sound. That makes sense. Genius.
So that's the end of side one, which is something that used to matter when
it outsold,
which apparently it is again.
Outsold CDs for the first time since 1987, I think. Vinyl did, which is lovely. We love that. You've just got yourself a nice vinyl player, I believe.
Yeah, you believe you recommended and helped.
That is also accurate. Also, fun fact: plural of vinyl is vinyl, which my old manager, who used to rock double denim and a very, very, very stiff Malay, used to write into head office when they would post vinyls sale on our intranet. So he'd write in and be like, "It's vinyl." Full stop. That was it.
I love people who get hung up on important stuff
it's,
like that.
I mean, he was not about it. Plural is vinyl, and that is that. There is no other answer. Shout out to Mills, who definitely won't be listening to this because he just, you know, reasons.
Yep. Fair enough. Okay. He's dead. All right. So let's go on to side two. It opens up. And Dave mentioned this song as well. He said it works. I'm a bit of a jury's out kind of guy on this one. Anyway, it's called Overpowered by Funk. And I guess it is what it says it is.
I just laughed because I reread my notes from listening to for the first time. And I just wrote Disco Remnants.
But is it Remnants? Because this is in 80s. When was Disco?
Wasn't Disco 70s as well, though?
Oh, maybe. But, I mean, this isn't Disco. This is Funk.
I don't know. They got similar origins.
Yeah, there's something there, right? Some sort of...
The other note I did write against this was Cowbell. I think it comes in closer to the chorus. There it is in the background.
And then, so at the end, Futura 2000 does a bit of an outro rap here. See if I can find it on the skip.
Isn't this, what's that Blondie song where it ends up just being Debbie Harry just like talking towards the end of the track?
I don't know, but let's listen to this Clash song that we're playing.
I can only like things if I relate them to previous knowledge, Matt. You know this.
So, yeah, that was Futura 2000 you were just talking over about Blondie for some reason. So you're into that? It's a good party tune, but it's one that it's just like on this album it sticks out like a sore thumb.
Not contextually. I don't like it contextually, but as a standalone, I dig it.
Yeah, but it's also weird because I mean every song on this sticks out. Like it's not like they're all running smoothly one to the next. So I don't know why that one stood out even more than the others to me. Maybe it's because it sounded a bit like a Blondie song.
That could be. That could be
That maybe that's all it was.
My ability to recall things is absolutely shitful. One day you guys might get a fact out of me.
The backup, so the side two of this album, after Overpowered by Funk, I do feel it's one of those ones that sort of just sort of flows over me, and I had to keep going, wait, I got to concentrate again, because I missed these. These just sort of ran on, and then I went, what was it again? I think I like all the songs individually, yep, but unlike the first one, that for some reason, just in my head, they're not as memorable. Yep. And then I'll listen back to them and concentrate hard, and I'm like, no, these are good songs. I don't know why that is. Anyway, his track 8, it's called Atom Tan. And this has got Jones back on some vocals. Well, it's Jones and Strummer, obviously.
You know what this sounds like? Nothing, I'm just joking.
I like this song.
I love double vocals. Can we do an episode about double vocals?
That's a good one.
Because it's so random, but I love it. It just adds like a thickness to the music.
Well, especially when it's jumping backwards and forwards like this.
Remix.
Yeah, so I like this one.
This is great. It's weird. Their vocals are so similar but so different at the same time. Do you know what I mean?
That is interesting, isn't it?
Until we listened to this album for this, literally this episode, I thought Joe Strummer sang all of it. So I didn't realize there was two different vocalists until I was researching. And then it's
interesting.
It's like it's sometimes it's obvious and sometimes it's not obvious for me, and because I would still call myself a relatively new beginner to it all. But it's interesting how obviously different, but then when you hear them separately, I find myself still second guessing who's singing it. It's weird.
Oh, gotcha. You know what I mean? Yeah, no, totally. I know that feeling when you're sort of sliding into something new, or not new, but getting into it deeper for the first time.
Yeah.
From the outside, things, you see the similarities, and then the more you get into something, it's like a genre of music or anything or a band.
Yeah.
Then you start picking up the subtleties as you go along.
Yep.
Another good one coming up, Sean Flynn. It's track 9. What's that? It's a bit of flute or something similar.
You're going to hate me for saying this. But do you know what this reminds me of?
What's that?
I wondered if like...
Jethro Tull.
No. Jethro Tull.
Feels like... It just feels like it's sunshine. There's a waterfall.
Oh, it does. It totally does.
To me, it feels like it's real idyllic sounding.
I was wondering if like Mighty Boosh had been inspired by this, because this was like super Boosh.
I would not be surprised if
Das Boosh.
They were into a bit of this.
You know what I will say about this whole album though? So like, my familiarity with The Clash was obviously not very deep, as we talked about earlier. So this album only being released, 5 years after 77, aka The Year of Punk, I was genuinely shocked at how broad the mix of genres were.
How quick their evolution was.
Yeah, it really, that's something that genuinely stood out to me, and I was a bit like jaw on the floor type of things hearing songs like this from, you know, like iconic punk band The Clash.
Because then you're like, you compare it to the Ramones or something, you never really changed.
To the best of my knowledge, they had a set sound and they stuck to it. They knew what worked and they went with it. But it really something that I did not expect from theirs at all. Like, most albums that we've listened to so far I've known of them and therefore had a bit of an idea of what it was going to be like, and this totally blew that open for me.
Yeah, right. Oh, yeah, so you didn't... You were thinking it was all going to be that sort of 77
sound.
Yeah,
well, like the...
Even though you knew some of those big...
I was like, yeah, because you know, same with some of the Chisel songs that we didn't realize were so far apart chronologically or like album wise. I thought that was all early and they were just like, we'll chuck some slow ones in there just for shits and kicks kind of thing. Right. I didn't realize it was such a development in their sound. So that was, I thought, a really, really interesting part of listening this week, this 3 weeks, whatever it's been. It's been a while. Sorry for the wait, everyone. We got here.
Well, I think it was sort of like what Dave was saying about having the different voices in the band, but they also all really wear their own influences on their sleeves. So that, and I think that's sort of what broke the band up. They were pulling in different directions a little bit.
Yeah, I think Mick Jones wanted to get a bit more experimental and broaden their horizons, and I think maybe Joe Strummer and a couple of others were kind of wanting to stick with like their sound idea.
But I think also, like, I mean, Strummer was the one who wrote Overpowered by Funk, and he was...
Oh, yeah.
He was going down his own different path.
He
so
was going down a funky,
I just
funky
think
track.
They... Yeah, the thing that made him great with all these different ideas ended up being the thing that broke him apart, because they just... I guess, they just weren't able to compromise with each other.
Yep.
And that's why after this album, Mick Jones leaves... and before the next album comes out, so does Topper. Or Topper's kicked out first and then Mick Jones leaves. Yeah.
They kicked him out because his heroin addiction had hit over 100 quid a day. Heroin and cocaine addiction. And it was starting to damage, or it was obviously damaging his health, and then was affecting his drumming. And they were like, you know, we're punk rock, man, but health is important. And we support that here at Listen Now. Health is important.
I think when you've got multiple creative forces in a band,
mm-hmm.
and they're pulling in different directions, that's when they break out. I think the bands that last the journey, they've either got one team, like a writing duo that can work together and have their jobs. One does lyrics, one does music, or something like that.
Don and
Don. The same page.
Yeah, yes, and that's what's important.
Whereas other bands, and Chisel are an example of this, where they'll there's multiple creative forces in the band.
Yep.
And as the others gain more confidence, that's when tensions arise. Yep. Often bands will start with one main creative force, like Strummer in The Clash or Don Walker in Cold Chisel. Mm-hmm. But over time,
people get confident.
I mean, it'd be a hard thing to do.
Yeah, like I want to put my opinion forward and everyone else is like, Mom, it's been 5 albums. Like, why now? And then it's just everyone's like, you know what? I got shit I want to do. Sorry about it. Got to go. GTG.
Bye. Yeah. Anyway, let's finish this album off. We've got 3 tracks to go. The next one's track 10, Ghetto Defendant. And this is the one that you mentioned earlier, which has Allen Ginsberg on it, a famous beat poet. Again, a song that sounds nothing like anything else on the album.
No, not at all.
That'll happen when you chuck a beat poet onto it.
Also, what a voice.
Hooked on Necropolis. Addict of Metropolis.
Do the worm on Acropolis. Slam dance Cosmopolis. Enlighten. When was beat poetry? What defines a beat poet? Oh, here you go. The Beat Generation was a literary movement started by a group of authors whose work explored and influenced American culture and politics in the post-war era. The bulk of their work was published and popularized through the 1950s, including Allen Ginsberg's How, which was 1956.
And then there was the Jack Kerouac on the road was another big one.
Interesting.
That must have been the 50s too, was it?
57 that was released, and William S. Burroughs' Naked Lunch in 59.
I think it was the, like, the... I was reading a, I think, Leonard Cohen's biography about him recently, and they were mentioning that, that the rock stars sort of took over from the beat poets as the...
Oh, as that's
the,
cool.
The big star, cool... The cool scene, maybe?
Yeah, so the origin of the name actually dates all the way back to 1948, which was introduced by Jack Kerouac. Characterizes a perceived underground anti-conformist youth movement in New York. That's cool. I'm learning a lot more today than I thought I would. The Beats...
All right.
Wait, before we continue, sorry. Real quick. The Beats had a pervasive influence on rock and roll and popular music, including the Beatles, Bob Dylan, and Jim Morrison. Hugely named as. But please continue.
Yeah.
To Inoculated City.
Yeah, so this was one that Dave name-checked as well in his review.
Yeah.
Said. And I think he's told me before that this was one of his favourite Clash songs growing up as well.
Excellent.
Inoculated City.
Imagine being a kid and you're like, what's your favourite song right now? Inoculated City by The Clash. I'd be like, it's The Wiggles, Big Red Car.
Another one with the dueling vocals.
And she's a little bit funky as well.
Yeah, I think Dave, because Dave's a bass player, I think that's
that
maybe
makes
influences
so much
his
sense.
Taste a little bit.
Yes. The bing, the bing, the bing.
When I said dueling vocals, it's not really dueling, is it? They're one on top of the other.
Yeah, but that's when we were talking about dual vocal songs earlier. This is actually what I meant specifically.
Right.
One of the bands I popped up in one of our weeks off, Robots in Disguise, which is funnily enough related back to Mighty Boosh. If you saw the post, you saw the post. You know what I mean? And all of their music, actually, I think it's four albums, it's both lead singers singing at the same time, but they've got different vocal styles, but it works somehow, and I just think it's super interesting. I'm all about it. Love some dual vocals. Dueling.
Yeah.
Either or.
Yeah, so that layered idea.
Yeah, I just think it's cool.
Harmonizing and whatnot.
Yeah.
You'd like the Beatles, they did a bit of that.
Oh, I don't know if I've heard of them. Should we do an episode about them? Do you reckon we could do an episode, or is that not enough?
I did have a thought at some point that we they would be a pretty great band to do a full back catalog show
that
on.
Would be
talk about a band hectic. Developing and
developing
a sound. And they don't have too many albums. I mean, they have quite a few, but because they were only around for 10 years, they don't have as many as other bands.
Which is also a wild idea. Like, people, as a general rule, I think Elvis Presley and the Beatles are quoted as probably two of the biggest influences on rock music ever. And yeah, the fact that they're only together for 10 years or around for 10 years, whatever. Like,
I think they're releasing music for 10 years. Maybe they were together a little bit longer than that.
Yeah, insane. Hey.
Don't tweet me. Don't at me.
Don't at me.
If I'm incorrect. So then the album finishes off with a real slow one called Death is a Star. Here it is. I'm guessing this is your least favorite on the album?
I didn't dislike this. This put me in, like, because I like to listen to these albums, because I don't think there's any that we've got on this list that I've ever heard the full way through, bar maybe one or two. So I like to listen to it completely without distraction for the first time, and it can really, like, get me into a mindset. And this was very much like I'm sitting in a lounge, like a dive bar type thing, and they're just like, that's the kind of music you're hearing. You're sitting on, like, red velvet. There's not a whole lot of light going on. I'm probably drinking a whiskey, that kind of vibe. That's how I felt. That's what I wrote down when I listened to it. So that, I probably never explained that before. When I listen to these albums for the first time, I'm talking over the music too much. But when I listen to these albums for the first time, I write down my immediate thoughts. And then The more I listen to it, the more that thought evolves, and sometimes it changes 160, but that was like, I'm in a dive bar type thing, but like in a good way, which is
funny. That's actually really deep.
Thank you. I'm a deep person with a lot of deep thoughts and feelings and emotions.
I reckon I got a different vibe. I want to be in that dive bar.
Sounds cool. Hey, love some Red Velvet.
I feel like I'm lying back and Joe Strummer's in the corner just singing me to sleep.
Like in a creepy way or a nice way?
No, in a nice way.
Oh, that's
nice.
Feels
like he's my dad or something. Sounds like it almost sounds like he's telling a fairy tale story or something. Even though I don't think I've ever taken in the lyrics, so I'm not really sure what it's about. I'm sure it's about how the world's fucked, though.
Probably. I mean, probably. Did I talk too much over it? Do we need to play a little bit more of it, or?
I know people can find it if they want to hear more of it.
That's fair. Google it. But yeah, that is Combat Rock by
The Clash. So that's the album. Yeah.
What do we do
what
next?
Do you reckon?
Do we rate it out of 80?
Unless you've got any fun facts, this is where you've been doing some fun facts you've had them.
I've got a couple of little random ones. So Joe Strummer's real name is actually John Graham Miller, which when you think Joe Strummer, you're like, wow, that's a great name for a musician. You're like, surely it's too good to be true. And in fact, it is. His dad was, I think, in the army or something. So Joe Strummer was actually born in Turkey and grew up, moved back to England when he was like 8 or 9, I think. 9. He got sent to boarding school with his brother, who was 10. And he said that he basically saw his parents once a year for a long, long time after that. Described the very expensive school that they got sent to, because he was a foreign service son of, it was a thick school. It was a school where thick, rich people sent their thick, rich kids. But he didn't have to deal with any of that because he was, you know, none of the bills were paid for by his family, which was apparently a good thing. He used to be called Woody, after Woody Guthrie, because of his love of rock and roll music. And he was a vegetarian from 1971 until he died suddenly of a undiagnosed heart condition at the age of 50, which I think was 2002. Yeah, December 2002 he died.
2002, yeah,
he's
right.
He's only 50, though, which is pretty sad, I reckon. That's pretty bloody young. Once upon a time, I probably would have said that's pretty bloody old, but nowadays, I'm closer to 50 than I am 0, so that's, you know, it's not that old anymore.
Yeah, do you have any other fun facts? I did find about Death as a Star. This is off songfacts.com. It says, singer Joe Strummer wrote the song and explained in an interview with Roz Raines in 1982 that the song is about violence in films and the public's desire to see executions, be that literally or in terms of a career. It's about the way we all queue up at the cinema to see someone get killed. These days, the public execution is the celluloid execution. I was examining why I want to go and see these movies, he said. An interesting idea is sort of saying, like, you know, the old school people used to go and watch people get murdered by the state.
Oh.
And now we're sort of filling that void with going to see movies like that, which is an interesting idea.
That's kind of
fucked
up.
I think that's, well, yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because the difference is we know this isn't real.
Yeah, that's true.
Which feels like a pretty big difference.
Is that a whole, like, human issue of tall poppy syndrome? We just like to see people cut down, whether it be figuratively or literally. You know what I mean? Like, that's a big,
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know if that's why people like to go into executions, but
I mean, that's,
I've never really thought about it too much.
That's hard. Other fun facts, Mick's grandma used to rock up to Clash gigs, which I think is pretty cool. Imagine.
That's cool.
Being like, all right, we're here to fuck everyone up tonight. G'day, Nan. And hey, Nan's hanging out the back like, fuck yeah. What a ledge. I don't know. I just reckon that's cool. Anyway.
That's cool. I like it a lot. I like that idea. I think more nanas should go to more punk shows.
Why not? If you're a nan and you go to punk shows, let us know. Because that's cool. Well, not this year in Australia. We've Corona. Never mind. I'm not going to say the full name because Voldemort.
So what... I don't know. I missed all that. Voldemort. I just heard you doing a Harry Potter thing at the end of
That's
it.
Fine.
So I assume it was something pretty cool.
The people that know will know. They will know.
So, we normally have been giving it the albums a rating out of 80.
Yep.
Rating out of 80.
Yeah, I don't know. We're still working on that.
And you teased me for giving all the albums a positive score.
Yep.
Because I'm a positive guy.
Yep.
But I'm actually really a positive guy. But I, again, you're going to hate it, but I love this album. Once again, it was a journey, which I enjoyed.
It was a real journey.
I wish I, because I can't remember any of the other scores I've given, and they're all sort of
above 60.
You're pulling numbers out of thin air, really. So I'd need to see some of those old numbers to really be able to give this a proper score, but... Gut feel, I'd say this is like a 69.
Nice.
Thank you.
Nice. I enjoyed this album more than I thought after my first listen. When I first listened to it, I was like, oh no, this is not what I expected. My mind was blown a little bit. And I am going to give it a 65. It's definitely something I'll listen to it again. I'm not going to put it into heavy rotation, but I really enjoyed it. It was different. There's a few songs that I'll absolutely give another listen to more than once.
Yeah,
even.
Should we talk about our standout tracks or something?
Yeah.
Do we always do that? We used to.
I actually don't know. I don't think we have for this, but I'm happy to start now. Why the bloody hell not, you know?
So the obvious ones, the ones that I knew coming in,
mm-hmm.
are all great. Mm-hmm. No, You're Right. Should I Stay or Should I Go? Rock the Casbah.
Yep.
And Straight to Hell.
Yep.
But then other new ones that I found that I really liked include, I think I mentioned this before, Red Angel, Dragnet.
Yeah, I'd be same, I reckon. Yep.
I really liked Adam Tan.
Yes, that was actually, I wrote Enjoy next to after the first listen. So, and that's only gotten stronger, which is lovely. Thank you, Adam Tan.
And, yeah, maybe Inoculated City as well. But, I didn't really dislike any of the songs on the album. Overpowered by Funk was the hardest work for me.
It was different. It was different, for sure.
But it was, I mean, it's fun. It's you can't fault that.
It is.
Funk
is
fun.
As a standalone, it's a bop. It's an absolute bop. And it's funny you said that you thought I hated Death is a Star, but that set such a proper mood for me for the first listen that I'm going to put that up there for me as well.
Yeah, I really like that track as well.
Cool.
I think just listening to it again, I do feel like, I definitely see the dive bar angle as well.
Yeah, I don't know. Vibes.
Yeah. Something about the music there, right?
Yeah. Yeah, the music definitely played into it, that's for sure.
It's late night.
Yep.
Late night.
Yeah.
You reckon the music was important in that song? Obviously the lyrics and the singing. They're the big three for me.
It obviously played a part in how I viewed the music.
The music played a part in how you viewed the music?
Yeah, like...
controversial, but okay.
Unpopular opinion, but the music really played a part in the music for me. So that's how I felt about the music.
I can see that, yeah. are there any letters coming in the letter bag to Alan?
We have got a couple of letters. One of them is a nice short and sharp. Hey, guys. This is from Andrea Mills, who's actually a mate of mine. Thank you for listening, Andrea, who I call Six Pack, because one time she got drunk off a six pack of cider and I've never let her forget that. And now people think she just has a six pack, which... is maybe true. I don't know. Anyway, Six Pack says, hey guys, loving your work. A Dire Straits fanatic should be known as a diabetic. You're welcome, Sam. Six Pack. Terrible. Hated
that would be
it.
Confusing.
Probably accurate.
You know, like if you're like, hey, you're meeting up with some of your other Dire Straits fans. You're like, hey, where are my diabetics at? And
some people are waving in their insulin in the air like they just don't care, and other people are just
confused.
The sultans of swing.
Yeah. Some have got little bags of jelly beans.
Yep.
Others are dads. Some are both. Some are both, and they were the ones that confused.
They're the most confused of all of them.
Yeah. Jellybean dads.
Jellybean dads. Just like old mate who fell off his table because he was so excited about the Clash.
Dad, the dad put down is such a hack put down, by the way.
I'm not trying to put him down. It's just accurate.
No, I said that.
Wow, Matt. Do you have a thing against dads? Is that what you're saying?
No, my dad's a dad.
I know a dad. At least one. Our other email in the bag today is from Marion. Hey, guys, I love the pod. Just listen to the Brothers in Arms episode. Fantastic. Thank you, Marion. I live in Delaware. Hi.
I'm from Delaware.
Delaware. and grew up in
the
80s.
Did she say that in the email or did you
No,
just
that's just
that
how
in.
I read it in my brain.
It is. It's such a... It's. For a long time, all I knew about Delaware was that Wayne's World sketch.
That's still all I know about Delaware and that Marion is from there.
I was watching this show on TV and it was like...
Tell me more, Sam. Give me more detail to that fact.
It was beach. It was like people trying to find beach homes and they were in Delaware. And it was just these perfect beaches. Like, Delaware's like beautiful beaches?
Unfamiliar. I'm going to Google the shit out of it. Google Maps?
It's on the sort of northeast coast, like a couple of states down from New York.
Yes. I'm picturing it with the U shape and then the Wang, Florida.
Yeah.
Whatever it's called.
That's absolutely blown my mind. But anyway, Delaware is some little
lovely
corner of paradise, apparently.
That's amazing. I'm absolutely going to spend some time on Google Maps satellite view after this. Marion grew up in Delaware in the 80s. This was one of my favorite albums, and Brothers in Arms is my favorite track by far. I was and currently am a huge fan of the TV show Miami Vice, and this song featured in the end sequence of the episode, Out Where the Buses Don't Run. One of my all-time favorite sequences. She has sent us a link, which I will post at some stage during this week, hopefully if I remember, writing myself a note. Let's just roll with that. The camera work, lighting, etc., we're all great, but Brothers in Arms elevates it to another level. I highly recommend giving the entire episode a watch. Obviously, it's a bit outdated. Solid episode. Don't read a synopsis. Ever. And that is her, mostly her email. And then they've signed it off as Shield Wolf.
Thank you so much, Shield Wolf.
And that is the bag. Oh, also, she says, P.S. I know Matt is a Saints supporter. Also, same. Did we talk about already that Nathan Burke, legendary number 3 of St. Kilda, has just had his daughter recruited as one of the earliest father-daughter rules? Also, is going to be playing AFLW as number 3 for St. Kilda. Very excited.
Very excited.
May have dropped a tear or two because I was very emotional.
That's going to be so good.
I was really excited.
Even though
so
Berkey works. Doesn't Berkey coach the dogs? Okay.
We don't talk about just like Robert Harvey works for a company. Works for a club.
You're such a corporate shill. Thinking of clubs as companies.
I know. However, I get to that brain set?
You're such
idea.
A business person, aren't you? Always
yes.
Making deals, shaking hands.
I like to play golf
meetings.
On a Thursday at lunch.
Hey, me too. Does that make me a businessman?
Yes, that is. Sick. Is that not business? No? Okay.
Sure. Cool. Not on the courses I play.
No.
I think when people picture golf, they picture like nice places. Or
is that not
smacking
golf?
Along piles of dirt like where I play? But
I attempted golf once this year at a place called Lockhart in New South Wales. If everyone could jump onto Google Maps Satellite, my favorite website actually ever, and look up the Lockhart Golf Club. It's mostly red dirt, overgrown pine trees, and yeah, that's it. And playing golf on that is near impossible for someone who dead set cannot play golf anyway. But anyway, Marion.
We are real bad at sticking to a topic. How do we
get
to
topic? topic?
How did we get to golf?
How did we get to Lockhart, New South Wales?
I don't know. What a journey.
Shield Wolf says, I know Matt is a Saints supporter, and I happen to be watching the Saints beat the Giants. It's three-quarter time. Hope the score holds. I am a Geelong member slash supporter, but I have a soft spot for the Saints because of Mr. Stewart. Are we playing Geelong this week? Next week?
No. Geelong played last night at the time of recording.
They lost, though.
But they're the double chance. They're still alive. We're going to do or die clash tomorrow.
If we win against Bulldogs tomorrow, are we playing Geelong?
No. Oh. We will play the loser of Richmond and Brisbane. But
fuck.
I'm not thinking that far ahead.
No. We're just happy That's to right. be here.
Well, think about this. We flogged Richmond earlier this year.
Did we?
And we only just lost to the Lions by 2 points.
I am a bad St. Kilda men supporter.
I know you are. I've known you a long time. I know you're a bad St. Kilda supporter. All over I'm here from
realistic.
You is complaining about losses.
Realistic.
No, you're not realistic. You're a nego. You're a big nego.
What did you call me? No, that's
support.
Fair. That's,
support that's the boys.
I bought a membership. Does that count?
That's pretty. That's something for sure. I think that definitely gives you more ability to whinge.
Yeah.
But anyway, let's just be excited. We made it to the finals first time in 9 years.
Yay!
Like whatever the result is, it's been a successful year, and hopefully we can build on it next year.
Yay. Please. And
some people are going to be listening to this knowing that we've either won or lost.
Yep.
And
some people are
going to
be listening to this being
they'll
like,
be happy or they'll be going, oh.
Yeah. Or they'll be listening to this being like, this has abso-fucking-lutely nothing to do with the clash. Why am I still listening?
There'll be some people who've turned it off. Yeah.
That's accurate. And to those people, goodbye.
Well, they're not listening. They're listening, Sam.
Fuck.
So. No point really giving them a message. What are we talking about?
Pass that
thanks
on.
So much, Shield Wolf.
Shield Wolf.
Go Saints.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. And hopefully the cat's still all right. I mean, you've done all right for a long time. It's almost boring.
Bastards.
So
yep.
You might. I imagine Geelong fans are kind of like, yeah, I guess we're playing finals again. Who cares?
Yeah. Oh,
we won three premierships within the last, 13 years or less?
I feel like it's been more and shorter, but maybe that's just me crying about it. I don't know. 1966 was a little while ago. I don't remember it personally. I wasn't born yet, so which is probably why, but that's cool.
Yeah, it could have been it.
Do we have anything else apart from... Yay.
No, that's all we do. I'll tell people if they want to know what the next... album is going to be.
Yes.
And, but yeah. Until then, goodbye, Astrid.
Goodbye.
This podcast is part of the Planet Broadcasting Network.
Visit planetbroadcasting.com for more podcasts from our great mates.
I mean, if you want. It's up to you.
Hey, Sam. This is the end of the episode bit where we tell everyone what the next album's going to be. I'll tell you what it actually is off the pod, okay? But I'm going to give everyone listening a clue. Or you can, you can
still
just
Avengers?
Get the clue as
are
well.
Are we still being Avengers?
No, I don't think... I think we...
Oh, we lost that?
Go months ago.
Samuel L. Jackson left us.
Yeah. So the opening lyric on the album we're going to talk about next, remembering it's a 1980s album, and I don't think there'll be another album that has this opening line anyway.
Interesting.
But the opening line is, belligerent ghouls run Manchester schools.
Interesting. I wonder what it will be.
Belligerent ghouls run Manchester schools. Well, put it in Google right now and you'll see.
How do you spell belligerent? I feel like it's got a U.
All right, well, let's end the podcast here and we can do that in our own time.
Good one.
Laters.
Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.